Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Energy Diplomacy at the U.S. State Department, Robin Dunnigan. Energy diplomacy is a part of nearly every energy-producing country's foreign policy, but the U.S. role is complicated by the fact that it, unlike most other countries, has a private energy industry rather than a state-owned or controlled industry. But with the resumption of U.S. crude oil exports this past December, and of course abundant natural gas to export, U.S. petroleum is playing an increasing role in the world stage, with facilities that just a few years ago were being built to import natural gas into the United States now being converted to export facilities. Robin Dunnigan is a career member of the U.S. Foreign Service. She served as the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Energy Diplomacy since 2014. There she oversees the Bureau's offices around the world. During her career in the Foreign Service, she served overseas in Vietnam, Chile, Turkey, Cuba, and El Salvador. In Washington, she's worked in the Bureau of Near Eastern Affairs and on the staff of the Secretary of State's 24-Hour Operations Center. She was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night. Robin Dunnigan, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Rich. It's wonderful to be here.
You know, we've seen a rally in oil prices and gas prices since that huge low we saw in the winter, and we're over $50 a barrel for oil now, but still consumers are pretty much benefiting here in the United States. But from your own energy diplomacy post, are low energy prices a good thing, a bad thing, or a bit of both, depending on what part of the world you're looking at?
I think low energy prices benefit consumers clearly, but for producing and exporting countries, sustained low energy prices can also be a challenge. As we look around the world right now, you look at a producer like Nigeria, for example, that is trying to deal with combating a terrorist threat with Boko Haram. You have a new government that's committed to reform. When you have oil prices continuing, you know, around 50, even though 50 is a bump up, it's certainly less than where we were a couple of years ago, over $100 a barrel. So sustained low oil prices for producing countries really does start to be a challenge. That's true in Nigeria. It's true in Venezuela. It's true for any producer around the world.
Yeah. From your post, is that what you're concerned about, is these low energy prices and their effects on that country's government and its stability?
We do. So at the State Department, you know, we are the only foreign ministry in the world, the United States, that has an entire bureau dedicated to energy issues. And the reason we establish that bureau and have it is the intersection between energy policy and our national security. So that is absolutely one of the things we look at. When you have sustained low oil prices and it's affecting a government's budget, its bottom line, its ability to fight terrorism or implement social programs, that can result in instability that has an impact on us. So absolutely, it's one of our areas of focus.
Of course, it's not an issue today, but say when domestic energy production was incredibly low in the United States, I imagine it was also about making sure that the United States always had clear supplies of imported energy.
That's an interesting question, because you go back 5 or 6 years ago when we didn't have the abundance of oil and natural gas production that we have today, and clearly there was a feeling that the United States had to be engaged around the world to ensure a sustainable supply of oil and gas. Even though we've had this dramatic, transformative increase in our own oil and gas production, we still need to pay attention to global oil and gas markets. We cannot afford to disengage from the world, because a disruption, an oil disruption in one part of the world, has an impact on prices and supply everywhere. Oil markets are global. And as we were just discussing, you know, sustained low oil prices can affect political stability, economic growth. It can affect government's ability to govern. So we are still absolutely engaged despite our own domestic production increase.
Of course, we're seeing a domestic energy output go down now because of the low prices. I think we're down to about 2014 levels as far as domestic energy production. Now, the good news is apparently with the oil shale technologies, it can be turned off and on, I guess, a little easier than a conventional oil field. Does that give the United States a competitive advantage?
That's a real lesson of the last couple of years of the low prices, is just how resilient our oil and gas sector has been in the face of lower prices. I think the unconventional gas technology and unconventional oil technology has shown that producers can come on and off and also squeeze their margins to remain profitable even at lower prices, in a way that many experts did not predict.
Yeah. Now, what we're seeing internationally now is that with these low prices, global energy demand is starting really to show a decent bump. And forecasts for the last part of this year and perhaps part of next year show a really healthy increase. I mean, we're at one point right at a little over 90 million barrels a day, and they're looking at global demand creeping up to close to 97.5. And that's less than 10%, but it's still a big healthy bump. What impact will this have, again, from a diplomatic standpoint, when you look at things like climate change, the growth of renewables, efforts to move transportation fleets from diesel and gasoline to more energy-conscious energy vehicles? What impact do you expect this to have?
It's really important to look at where the demand is coming from. It used to be that demand was really driven by the OECD countries, primarily by the United States and Europe, were driving global energy demand. That has dramatically shifted to the non-OECD countries, primarily to China, India, Southeast Asia. Those are the new demand centers, really driving the demand for oil and natural gas in the world. And I think when you look at that shift, you have to really ask, how are we going to meet these new demand centers in these developing countries in a way that's sustainable, allows economic growth, but also addresses our climate change objectives? And what it's going to require is a diverse approach that includes some hydrocarbons, of course, natural gas as a transition fuel, but also increasing investments in renewable energy. One very positive and interesting factor that was sort of unexpected for many analysts was that even when prices were high, despite what's happened to oil prices over the last couple of years, investments in renewable energy have increased, steadily increased. Last year was, I think, over $300 billion investments in renewable energy around the world. So it's a huge new growing market, and that's good news.
Yeah. Now, are China, India, and Southeast Asia, where the demand is being driven, are they still investing in renewable energy?
Absolutely.
Or is there a case to be made for when energy prices are low, take advantage of those low energy prices?
Even when prices were low last year, places like China continued to invest heavily in new renewable energy technology, deploying new wind, new solar, biomass, the whole range of renewable technologies. Even here closer to home in the Caribbean, you know, we have in the Caribbean, many island states were small markets, heavily dependent on heavy fuel oil. Even in the last year with lower oil prices, many countries like Jamaica, St. Kitts and Nevis invested in new renewable projects. A real dramatic shift is happening with a recognition that renewable energy is not only good for the climate, it's good business.
Now, another big change in the United States in regard to the rest of the energy market in the world is all of a sudden the U.S. now is able to export raw oil, I guess, able to send out gas, been able to send out coal, obviously, and refined gasoline, but actually crude oil, we're able to export this. What impact does that have?
The United States lifting the export ban on crude oil, we did that in December, means that we're still going to be a net importer of crude oil, but it means that we're contributing to a more stable, market-driven global oil supply. That's a good thing for markets. It's a good thing for consumers. And probably more importantly, or equally important, is the revolution in our natural gas exports. 7 years ago, if we were having this conversation, or when President Obama came into office, I'm sure he was briefed by his energy team that the United States is going to be a massive importer of natural gas. And we need to have relationships with suppliers, and we need to build the import facilities. And that's what we were doing then. You know, 7 years ago, we were building natural gas import facilities. About a month ago, I was in Louisiana at Sabine Pass for the opening of the first global-scale liquefied natural gas export facility, the first LNG export facility in the lower 48. We had one in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to start putting significant quantities of liquefied natural gas onto the market. So those import facilities that we were building 7 years ago, we're now converting into export facilities. And that is a remarkable change on natural gas markets globally, just that shift not only in our own consumption, but that we're going to be exporters.
Now, I know you're a State Department veteran and not an energy veteran. You come to it from the State Department. Are those facilities easily transferable back to being import plants if conditions change 10 years down the road?
You can convert, as we've seen. Mm-hmm. I don't know the cost that it would require to take a massive LNG export facility and return it to an import facility, but the estimates are that due to unconventional gas development technologies, we're going to continue to be a major producer and exporter of natural gas for the foreseeable future. I don't anticipate that we're going to start needing to import natural gas anytime soon.
Now, what I'm reading is that a lot of people are in Europe are looking to United States supplies of LNG, especially as a counterweight, because many countries, especially in the eastern part of Europe, have seen natural gas used as a political weapon from Russia just a few short years ago. How important is that?
I think it is essential. Many analysts look at the beginning of LNG exports from the United States as a big energy achievement and very important for the United States energy security. And it is. It absolutely is. It's great for the United States, our own economic growth, and for our own energy security, the natural gas revolution. But it's also an important foreign policy achievement. Our allies in Europe are heavily dependent on, in many cases, one supplier of natural gas. And we can put a name to it. The supplier is Russia. And Russia will continue to be an important supplier of natural gas to the European market. It will be. It should be. But no country should be 100% dependent on any source for its energy, for all of its natural gas. So injecting competition, injecting new supplies into that market in Europe will help drive a more competitive, market-based natural gas market in Europe. And we've already sent one cargo of natural gas to Portugal, the company that Cheniere has. Mm-hmm. And that's a good thing. It's good not only for our energy security, it's good for the energy security of our partners and allies in Europe.
And I'm hearing there's more gas that may be looking at Scandinavia and probably towards at least middle Europe and Eastern Europe.
There are LNG import terminals all over Europe. They're in the Baltics. They're in Western Europe off the coast of Spain. There are LNG import terminals and floating storage import terminals, storage and import terminals all over Europe. And I think any of those facilities could start importing U.S. natural gas, and I hope they do.
Yeah. Now, one of the other parts of the equation is the United States is not the only country in the world that's now all of a sudden exporting LNG. I mean, I'm hearing Australia's got exportable supply. I think Qatar in the Middle East is making a big investment. Is that a good thing overall, the fact that there are many countries willing to send LNG, especially to a place like Europe where it's really dependent on one source?
What we're going to see is a very well-supplied LNG market. I'm not a commodities trader. I'd probably be working in New York making a lot more money if I could exactly predict where gas markets were going to go. But you're absolutely right. Qatar is putting big supplies of gas onto the market. Australia is going to put massive amounts of natural gas onto the market. Eastern Mediterranean, there have been big natural gas finds off the coast of Israel, Cyprus, Egypt. With our own supplies, we're going to have a very well-supplied natural gas market. That will mean more competition. It will mean, most likely, it will mean a decoupling to some extent of natural gas prices from oil prices. And that's going to be good for consumers. It's going to be a good driver of economic growth.
My guest today is Robin Dunnigan. She's a Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Energy Diplomacy. She was the guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations, speaking on the global outlook for energy. And she's our guest today here on Studio Tulsa. Well, there is one caveat for the United States, for government in sending LNG and oil exports. It's not the government sending out this. This is private business in the United States, as opposed to other countries where they have state energy companies. And it is a diplomatic tool of where you send your energy resources and exports. What difficulty does that add for, say, the Department of State or Department of Energy? Because it is a private economy and those private companies are going to sell where the price is best, not necessarily where the United States can reward friends and punish, you know, not friends.
Rich, you are absolutely right. We do not and cannot direct where our natural gas or our crude oil goes. We have market-based economy. Our companies decide where they're going to send their cargoes. I often travel around the world, and I'll be asked a question, when is the United States going to start sending us its LNG? When can we benefit from the low natural gas prices in the United States? And can you make sure that some of those commodities come into our markets? Well, I can put you in touch with the U.S. producers and sellers and marketers of our natural gas and our oil, and we're very happy to do that, and we do that. But direct the companies where to sell it, it's just not the way America works.
Does the government have any influence at all? I mean, I suppose if Congress had some sort of import-export ban, I suppose that would be some influence, but that would be an act of Congress.
Well, our crude oil exports, now that the ban has been lifted, so that did influence the ability of companies to export. The natural gas exports are governed by the Natural Gas Act and the Department of Energy, but all of the new natural gas facilities that are being built, the new LNG export facilities, they have licenses to export that gas anywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. So in the end, it will really be the companies that decide where to send their product. But you asked if we have an influence. One thing we do, the State Department does it, the Commerce Department does it, the Department of Energy does it, is we advocate for U.S. products and U.S. companies. I always say that, you know, given a level playing field, I'll put a U.S. company against another foreign company. I'll put my money on the U.S. company any day. We have the best technology. We follow the rules. We have great products. And this is true in the energy sector as it is in other sectors.
Yeah. Now, you can see the effect of LNG exports and crude oil exports for the United States for, you know, the diplomatic influence. But it also has an effect on domestic energy costs. Here in the oil patch, we would like to see oil prices a little higher. And one of the things the crude oil ban, export ban, did was when we were oversupplied here in the country, it actually depressed the domestic oil price, didn't it?
You know, I think there are a lot of factors that go into the price. You know, one clearly is demand. And so over the last couple of years, we did see stagnating demand. We saw a very well-supplied market. We saw some major producers deciding to keep production at high levels, for example, Saudi Arabia. So there are a number of factors that go into oil prices.
One of the things I just learned about the factors is the Federal Reserve plays a big role, somewhat of a role, in the fact that by not raising interest rates, the dollar goes lower, the price goes up.
Exactly. So there are so many factors that go into oil prices. I was in New York 4 or 5 months ago, and we were sitting around a round table with some analysts, and somebody said to probably a very well-paid analyst, you know, give us your best bet. Where price is going to be next year? And the gentleman said, I'm thinking between $20 and $80 a barrel. And I thought, come on, how much are you getting paid to make that guess? You know, I could guess 20 to 80. That's a pretty big range. But the truth is, in his defense, it's hard to guess. You know, no one would have guessed 5 years ago that we'd be sitting here today talking about U.S. exports of LNG, that we'd be talking about the U.S. exporting crude. We had a ban, that we'd see prices go from $100 a barrel to below $30 a barrel in the course of a year and a half. The person who tells you they know how and where oil markets are going is probably, if they're betting right, they're making a lot of money.
But they're betting.
Exactly.
And that's one of the things, you know, I was reading a couple of reports from BP and Shell, and they're saying, we're thinking low prices are sort of here to stay, the sort of the permanent normal. That can change around in an instant. I mean, if something, God forbid, an act of terrorism in an oil-producing state, or, you know, even some of the price spikes we've seen here in the last week or so, some of it has been in part of the Federal Reserve's policy, but it's also, you know, you've had disruptions in Nigeria and in Canada due to the wildfires on the shale oil up there.
Rich, you're absolutely right. I mean, look at some of the disruptions that we have right now. The wildfires in Canada was temporary, but nevertheless, it took significant quantities off the market. Nigeria is down more than 500,000 barrels a day right now due to the attacks off the coast. We have Libya at pretty low production right now. We have Iran coming back online after, you know, Iran's oil exports were limited during the negotiations. After the sanctions on their exports were lifted, they've been coming back on slower than many thought. But all of these factors, you have, you know, production in Iraq, Iran, Nigeria, Libya, all over the world, if you have a major disruption, if you have two or three at a time, suddenly prices will start to reflect that.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the impact of low oil prices on a couple of key oil producers. One, Venezuela. We're seeing an economy in shambles. I mean, really, I would think this is a major topic of concern at the State Department. What's going on with Venezuela, and how does the State Department see the country right now?
Venezuela is having a very difficult time right now, and it's not only the impact on Venezuela itself, it's the impact on the countries to which Venezuela was providing subsidized oil, in the Caribbean and Central America in particular, through its Petrocaribe subsidy program. We actually started looking at this a couple of years ago, looking at the dependency on most of the Caribbean and many countries in Central America on this subsidized oil arrangement it had with Venezuela. And we thought, okay, this can't be sustained, and if and when Venezuela stops or decreases its subsidies through this program, what happens to our friends and allies in the Caribbean and Central America? So we started working with those countries many of which were already trying to diversify their energy picture through a couple of different initiatives. One was the Caribbean Energy Security Initiative that Vice President Biden launched in 2014, and then through a task force for Caribbean and Central American energy security that President Obama launched last year. Through these programs, we've dedicated a lot of technical assistance, resources, and engagement to work with our partners in the region to try to diversify away from sort of subsidized heavy fuel oil from one source. And we've seen a lot of success.
What would be the biggest success story so far?
I think looking at a country like Jamaica that's implemented new big wind and solar farms over the last couple of years. I mentioned before St. Kitts and Nevis, which is on its way to developing its geothermal resources. There are a number of cases like that. Central America has taken incredible steps to improve its regional electricity line. And by sharing, by building and increasing the transmission on this electricity line that goes all the way through and connects the markets, it means that they can trade electricity, making it more affordable, more efficient. So we've really seen some progress. And when Venezuela did cut its subsidies by about half in many cases over recent months, these countries were in a better position to deal with it. And so we've seen some progress.
How was the stability of able to produce oil in Venezuela? We're hearing a lot about electric outages, grid problems within Venezuela, which that's going to affect oil production itself.
And my understanding is that many of the oil production areas actually have their own electricity system, so are somewhat cordoned off from the electricity outages that are affecting the population. But clearly, when you have sustained economic challenges and inability to meet some basic needs of the population, like electricity,
they can't contribute to the stability of the country.
That's right. And so we are really focused on Venezuela right now and looking at how it's another good example of the importance of producing countries to diversify their economies. You know, this is you're not going to have $100 oil forever, and when it's a very good lesson right now that a diversified economy is a stronger economy.
Mm-hmm. Well, if I can take you into some more diplomatically sensitive areas, and that would be Saudi Arabia. Now, Saudi Arabia, OPEC meeting concluded last week. Nothing's changed in the oil production, but a lot of analysts are looking at Saudi Arabia, and maybe not this year, maybe not even next year, maybe but 3 or 4 years down the road, given where oil prices are today, if that stays the same, that this country could have some serious issues because they're drawing down on their cash reserves. They're still pumping oil. They're not getting as much money coming in. And you also have a country that has a basic lack of freedom within it. And all of a sudden, there could be unrest pretty quick if things keep progressing as they are. What is the State Department doing on the Saudi Arabian front as far as low oil prices impacting that country?
Well, a couple of elements of that question. One is OPEC and what OPEC decides to do. And the last two meetings when OPEC did not agree to freeze production, I don't think that was a big surprise. You know, Iran had said that they were coming back online, that they were going to continue to increase their production until they were at their pre-sanction level. And even if OPEC had agreed to freeze production, production's at an all-time high right now. So you'd be freezing production at an all-time high. So I don't think that there were big surprises coming out of the last meeting where there was no agreement. What it means for Saudi Arabia, Saudi Arabia has taken some recent steps that do reflect the recognition that diversification in the economy is important. They've just announced a Vision 2030 program that really seeks to diversify the economy by investing in a new technology sector, in tourism, even diversifying more in their energy sector by deploying more renewables so that they will have more natural gas to export, for example. They've talked about possibly privatizing part of Aramco. So Saudi Arabia, I think, is taking a good, hard, long look at how it diversifies its own economy and is very much aware that sustained low oil prices has an impact. And so we will continue to work with Saudi Arabia as a partner as they look to do this. And we have a robust trade and investment dialogue and relationship. And as they try to implement Vision 2030, we will definitely be working right alongside them.
My guest today is Robin Dunnigan, a Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Energy Diplomacy. She was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations, speaking on the global outlook for energy. So in the last minute or so, what is your global outlook for energy for the next year or so?
Since I'm not an energy analyst, maybe what I should say is, what's the global outlook for the intersection between energy and national security? we are focused, very much focused on diversification. For United States and for our allies around the world, diversification of energy sources is critical for your own economic growth, for your political stability, and for your climate goals. So it really is a focus of ours working with our partners. Are you dependent on one source? Is it only oil? How do you diversify? How do you deploy more renewables? How do you get different sources of natural gas? How do you diversify your fuel sources? We in the United States have an all-of-the-above energy strategy. It includes nuclear, it includes hydrocarbons, includes renewables, and it includes energy efficiency and demand management. And the United States is really a leader in all of these areas. Not only are we an energy superpower, for lack of a better word now, in hydrocarbon production, but we're world-class technological leaders on renewable energies, on energy efficiency, and on demand management. So looking ahead, I think that if you really, the way we will work with our partners and allies on the, around the world is to help them, where it's necessary, move to more diverse, stable energy systems.
Let me ask you one last question. It has to do with, again, energy management and reduction policies. Certainly in the 70s and early 80s, when we had the huge energy spikes there, we got interested in consumption and how we can reduce consumption. But once oil prices went back low and stayed low for a while, a lot of that went by the wayside. Is there a concentrated effort to make sure that if low energy prices stick around for a while, that we're still continuing on this path away from overall use of hydrocarbons the way we used them, say, 10 years ago or 5 years ago or even last year, you know, as far as moving the fleet away from gasoline and diesel?
Absolutely. In December, when the oil export ban was lifted, we also extended the tax credit for wind and solar renewable projects, an incredibly important move to continue to spur the investment that we need. Over the last 7 years, we've increased our electricity generation in solar and in wind manyfold, 20-fold for wind, I believe, and 7-fold for solar. It's incredible. And that's continued during low oil prices. So if you go out to California and Silicon Valley and you talk about oil production and pipelines, you know, you're likely to get a laugh, and people will say, pipeline politics with battery storage and new energy efficient buildings and energy efficient appliances and what we're doing on renewables, we're not going to be moving oil and gas by pipelines in 30 years. Now, I think that's a bit optimistic.
I think that is too.
But I do think that the technology will continue to drive a cleaner, more sustainable energy sector in the United States and abroad.
Robin Dunnigan, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Robin Dunnigan is the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Energy Diplomacy at the U.S. State Department. She was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.